This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Our panel of trumpet writers is eager and ready to discuss the important events of this week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
It's good to be here.
Well, it has happened. Donald Trump has been sworn in as President of the United States. As this airs, they're just wrapping up the inaugural parade on Pennsylvania Avenue. In a lot of ways, this marks a significant change in the world as nations recalculate their foreign and domestic policies to accommodate this change in leadership in what has been the world's most influential country for a couple of decades now. In a lot of other ways, it looks like this will only intensify or accelerate certain trends that are already unfolding in the world. We're going to talk about a number of these on our program today. One really interesting area to look at is Europe. America's new president has threatened to shake up the established world order by praising Brexit, criticizing the European Union, saying NATO is obsolete, and reaching out to Russia. And how will Europe respond to what really are pretty significant provocations? We're going to start this discussion by giving the floor to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, last Sunday, actually, then President-elect Donald Trump had given quite a groundbreaking interview, a joint interview with Germany's The Bild magazine and The Times of London, where he kind of laid out some of his his worldview. And he definitely was very laudatory of Brexit. He'd accused the European Union of basically being like this vehicle for German ambitions, or this this economic scheme so Europe could outcompete the United States on the world scene. He predicted that more nations would be leaving the European Union. He said that he thought NATO was obsolete because it had been formed so many years ago to be like a U.S.-European alliance against Russia. And had mentioned that if he can cut some deals with Russia to do things like fight ISIS in the Middle East or get like a nuclear reduction pact, he would be willing to lift sanctions on Russia too, which would have a number of nations in Eastern Europe like Ukraine and the Baltics quite nervous. But this is really showing that in some ways, and like a Cold War type level, this is really something we haven't seen since World War II, where you're almost seeing like a U.S., British, Russian alliance against Europe. Mm-hmm. And I know the some key officials in the Obama administrations have really blamed Nigel Farage for a lot of that. He was one of the architects behind Brexit, or the leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party at the time, who has pretty close relations with Donald Trump. And so as one of Barack Obama's representatives to the EU was thinking that, in his opinion, Nigel Farage was misleading Mr. Trump and trying to convince him that the European Union was the bigger threat to America as opposed to Putin's Russia.
So he made a whole lot of really interesting points, and they're really, some of them, points that we have made quite a bit on the Trumpet, in the Trumpet magazine. And but stating these outright, first of all, it does mark a significant break from the Obama administration policies. How are European leaders reacting to these words from Mr. Trump?
Right. Well, it was actually... And so, of course, this interview wasn't necessarily new things for the Trump administration. He'd been saying some of these things here or there for some time. It's just this is kind of where he put it all together. So even before the interview, which he gave on Sunday, last Friday, even Angela Merkel had given a speech in Brussels where she was really saying that we can't take our alliance with the United States for granted. It may not last forever. We have to be prepared to have like this pan-European Union military or a united European bloc that would be able to defend us if the United States wasn't involved. And she talked a lot about even Brexit as well being kind of like an opportunity for Europe to kind of have this millstone off their neck to push forward with some of these pan-European projects. So there is one of the articles we have in our Trumpet Weekly by Carnegie Europe had really mentioned that Europe's almost kind of seeing this kind of like this old German fear of encirclement, where, you know, World War One, World War Two, they were worried about having a rival on both sides. And so, and you see like Donald Trump really criticizing Germany's ambitions and looking at more reaching out to Russia. Now they're looking like, okay, well, now we have an anti-EU America on our right side and an anti-EU Russia on our left side. We'd need to get our act together because we've got people on both sides of us.
Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, I think there's an even more direct threat than encirclement. And this, I don't think I've seen much at all out there in the press. But when you put together everything that Donald Trump said in that speech, it's a major, major threat to Germany. Now, Germany's economy is 50% exports. And America's economy is 10% exports. So if America's exports decrease by a few percent, it's a bit of a headache. It's a problem in a few regions. If German exports decrease a few percent, it's economic meltdown. And if you look at what Donald Trump was saying in that speech, first of all, he was having a go at BMW and putting a 35% tax on BMW. The United States right now is currently the number one destination for German exports. So any kind of American clampdown on German free trade is a huge issue for Germany. Mm-hmm. Then he attacked the European Union. And he called it, like Andrew said, a vehicle for German ambition. He talked about, you know, apparently his team, for example, have been calling EU leaders saying, well, who's going to leave next? He says, I believe other people will leave. You know, the United States has been backing the European Union and encouraging the European Union since the 1950s or before. And now he's turning against that. Even Mr. Obama, during the height of the euro crisis, was going calling people who were causing trouble for Europe, like Greek leaders, and saying, hey, no, you guys need to stick together. Absolutely nothing from that from Donald Trump. And again, Germany's exports, most of them go to the Eurozone, and they're able to sell these exports because of the euro, because of the European Union. And so by threatening Europe's exports to Germany, Europe's exports within the European Union, this is a fundamental – these are like Germany's top fundamental issues that he's threatening. And things that could directly feed through to Germany very, very quickly in terms of an economic crisis. And you look at where German politics is already – you can start to see if you start to see some of these exports slow down, it's not hard to see that fall into just the biggest political crisis Germany has faced since the Weimar Republic. You know, a major, even existential issue for Germany cropping up now from what Donald Trump is talking about.
And it seems that reactions among European leaders and especially German leaders really did reflect exactly the kind of existential threat that you're talking about here.
Well, I don't know. I think they're still a bit hopeful that Donald Trump's not going to follow through on all that he's saying. I think there's just a bit of wishful thinking. There was still a lot of, especially from the German foreign minister, who I think is slated to be the next German president, was very, very critical of what Donald Trump has said. There was a lot of determination for Europe to do more, but I don't think it's hit them yet just how big of a change is coming to Europe. I think Europe has – I'm writing an article on just how Europe has been in Germany and America's shadow since World War II. And I think as even ancient Greek philosophers wrote, you know, we live in a world where the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. And Europe has been immune from that for the last 70 years. They've been protected from that by America. That is getting withdrawn under Donald Trump. And so they're going to just face some serious blows now unless they make some – and they're going to have to make some very, very big changes. And so I think they do accept that there's something big coming, but I don't think they quite see the scale of what's going to hit them pretty soon yet.
Yeah, and there have been at least two editorials I've seen in the past month by Dr. Edmund Stoiber, who's an elder statesman for Germany's Christian Social Union Party, where he makes the case that because of some of Trump's comments about NATO, it is imperative that Europe build a pan-European military and that Europe really unite. But he also makes the case that, in his opinion, he thinks that Trump's outreach to Putin might even be helpful for a pan-European Europe. But if he can cut some deals with Putin, that would decrease tensions there, that I guess at least in the short term, that that could help with some of this arms race you're seeing on the EU-Russian border.
Well, with this kind of rhetoric coming from Donald Trump, it definitely increases the pressure on Europe. These threats that you're describing definitely are going to become closer to reality very soon. With the inauguration today, you can see how this is going to force Europe to make some tough choices ahead. And it seems like whenever that happens within Europe, it's always Germany that comes to the fore. They're always the ones that end up having to take the lead. Before we leave this question, I want to talk about another very alarming story that came out of Germany this week. It was printed in the New York Times that should give the whole world pause about the dangers of putting more power in Germany's hands, which, again, it looks like the circumstances right now are poised to do. For this story, we're going to go back to Richard.
That's right. This story is about probably the most shocking speech I've seen from recent times. I mean, I was listening to this speech. It's in German. I speak a very tiny bit of German, but it's still interesting to get a feel for the crowd and things. And I was listening in my office and someone said, "Oh, you're listening to something from the 1930s. But it's not. It's from Tuesday. And this was a big rally. It was a rally in Dresden, an alternative for Deutschland rally in a crowded hall. And until now, I've tried to avoid calling the alternative for Deutschland far right. I mean, we're very concerned with them. We know where they're leading. But until now, they've not been all that different from Donald Trump. But this speaker, Björn Höcke, he took things, I think, to just a whole nother level with his speech there, talking about how Germany's past has been made to look ridiculous, he said. We need to take pride in our past. He talked about how, Germany, we're the only nations, the only people in the world to plant a monument of shame in the heart of its capital. And by that, he was talking about the Holocaust memorial in Berlin. He made a whole load of other, just very dramatic comments about Germany's history. And what really, though, stood out to me a lot from this was then the reaction with the crowd, the cheers, the applause, the chants of Deutschland, Deutschland from the audience there watching him. And I thought this article in the New York Times just made a really good point about how different this is for Germany, how not just in terms of what he's saying, but a charismatic German leader making these comments, working up the crowd. German politicians have shied away from that. You look at Angela Merkel, she's very competent, but she doesn't whip crowds into just this furor of applause and adoration. And that's not typically the way politics is done at all over in Germany. But it was a new style of politics, and it's met with just this great enthusiasm. And as it points out, a great enthusiasm from well-dressed 20-year-olds. It's not, like older people say, with nostalgia for the Nazi regime. It's young people. It says they look clean-cut, prim, trendy. So it's a growing move, and they just talk about how there's this growing movement, and they're at 15% and really thriving.
Yeah, 15%. Maybe you could just give us a brief indication of just how remarkable it is that a party of this type would get that kind of support.
Right. Well, a few years ago, they were making news that they got 5%. Now, to be fair to the Alternative for Deutschland, this leader's comments got a lot of criticism from within their own party. Mm-hmm. And the party leader, Frauke Petri, said that they were out of line. So they are kind of trying to distance themselves from those comments that they were that extreme. But it's when you look at the reaction of the crowd and how enthusiastic people were to this type of a speech. And we say 15% for the Alternative for Deutschland. In general, the left party, which really is every bit as radically left as the Alternative for Deutschland is on the right, they're also on 15%. And they are the holdovers. They're basically the successor party to the communists and the far left that ruled the Soviet authorities that ruled in East Germany, and they're really quite a fringe and really a very extreme party. So you're starting to get about 70% of Germans looking at these very extreme parties. So, you're looking at some big political developments within Germany.
Yeah, because it really almost makes the risk of making Germany almost ungovernable to have these third parties rising up. There's going to be an election sometime late this year in Germany.
September 24th. It's been announced.
And I was looking at the polls a weekend ago, looking at just like what coalition options they have on the table. And it looks like right now that the only two viable coalitions that would get you above 50% is you could keep the current grand coalition between the Christian Democrats or the Social Democrats, or you could have a coalition between the Christian Democrats and this alternative for Deutschland. Merkel said that will never happen under her leadership, although some of the regional politicians within the Christian Social Union say that they would prefer to have a coalition with the Alternative for Deutschland over the Social Democrats. So whatever the case may be, if between the left party and this Alternative for Deutschland, if they start getting much more support, your number of viable coalition options is plummeting.
And that just feeds into their support even further, because that's this is what a lot of comments of Alternative for Deutschland people are making. Well, no matter who we vote for, we end up with this left-wing, right-wing coalition. It would be like in America if every year it's ruled by a coalition between the Republicans and the Democrats, and the people at the top are just kind of the people in the middle from both parties. It just kind of feels like, well, whoever we vote for, we end up with just this vaguely kind of center-left party. And it's that frustration that is prompting people to vote for the Alternative for Deutschland. And so you see – you know, that those votes cause more unworkable coalitions, which then cause more people to vote for the Alternative for Deutschland. And then what happened in the 30s is that feedback cycle just got out of control, and you got more and more people just getting pushed towards the fringes, because and the more they did that, the less effective the center became.
Very interesting and important trend to watch there in Germany. This is something that we've talked about quite a lot over the years, of just how much this trend in politics in Germany is prophesied in the Bible to produce a strong single leader that's going to stand up and get the crowds in Germany excited once again and tap into that nationalist sentiment within that country. And you see the pressure increasing almost every week toward that end. So definitely something that we need to keep our eyes on. We appreciate that, gentlemen. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. As Donald Trump begins his presidency, there's been a lot of discussion about how this will boost the power of Vladimir Putin's Russia. President Trump certainly seems open to the idea of ending sanctions and improving ties with Russia. One analyst says that when you look objectively at what Russia is accomplishing under President Putin, Russia already rules the world. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Russia has more land than any other nation. You know, it takes up more space on our maps than any other country. But in some really big areas, it's not really as large as we might think. It has about 140 million people, so that makes it the world's ninth most populous nation. Bangladesh has more people. Nigeria has more. Mexico has almost as many. And then also in terms of wealth, Russia is far from the top. It's not even in the top 10, actually. It's got a GDP of $1.3 trillion. So that makes it come in at less than Canada. It earns less money than Canada each year, less than South Korea, less than Italy, Brazil, or France. But despite all of this, despite not being really that powerful in some of the ways that should matter most, Russia is utterly dominating foreign affairs around the world. We've published an article this week. It's from the National Post, and it's called "Why Russia, a Country with Less Money Than Canada and Fewer People Than Nigeria, Runs the World." And I think this article does a really good job showing, first, that Russia is running the world in some major ways, and second, why it's able to do so despite those limitations that it has. This National Post article says the main reason that Russia punches above its weight to such a degree is because of what it calls the large enough principle. I'll just read one quote from the article here. It says, Sometimes a derringer is just as effective as a smart bomb. Russia's military spending is only one-tenth that of the U.S. It has fewer military personnel than India. And the smoke-billowing flagship of the Russian Navy has to be followed everywhere by a tug in case it breaks down. And yet, this all seems to be plenty for a country that's very good at commanding global influence on the cheap. Crimea was seized without firing a shot. The Syria intervention required only about 50 aircraft and cost only $500 million, exactly the same amount the U.S. spent on training Syrian rebels. With Russia, it may not be so much the size of the army, but the fact that they are demonstrably willing to use it.
Mm-hmm. So, and what is the some of the areas you mentioned? Crimea, you mentioned Syria, some other areas that, in the Post's view, are evidence of Russia actually ruling the world, as it puts it.
Well, since Vladimir Putin came to power on the last day of 1999, Russia has actually deployed its armed forces into at least five different theaters of conflict. So there's Russia, but then there's also Chechnya, the Caucasus border region, Georgia, and Ukraine as well. So I just think that point about the will to use their power is such a powerful one. That's one that we've talked about very often on the Trumpet. We talk about will as being really the big missing ingredient with America's power.
Mm-hmm.
We have all kinds of military power. You know, I think if you total up the next 6-7 countries on the world who are the top spenders, that comes to about what we spend. But yet, since we don't have the will, as was very specifically prophesied, it doesn't amount to that much.
Right. Yeah, you certainly see the disparity in will between the United States and Russia, and Vladimir Putin is very good at marshaling his resources to the best possible effect. And it's just, it is interesting to look at exactly what has Russia has accomplished given the resources that it has. It makes you wonder what the United States would be able to do if it were marshaling its resources as effectively. I'm sure there are a lot of people that are hoping that that does happen. But is it possible that Russia having such a paucity of resources relative to the United States, that would suggest that there would be limits to Russia's ability to project power?
Well, I think there are definite limits. But what we see Russia doing is pushing everywhere it can to the absolute extent of those limits.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas a country like the United States spends all of its time very gingerly using the full extent of what it could use and only gently, you know, exercising the extent of its power, you see Russia reaching as far as it possibly can and then a little bit further, just, you know, pushing to the full limitation of what it could do.
Well, one area that Russia has really made remarkable progress in increasing its influence is the Middle East. We're putting our March edition of our Trumpet News magazine together right now. We have a couple of articles detailing some of Russia's conquests. We have a map in there of territory that Russia has taken control of under President Putin. But as far as Middle East goes, we've been tracking details of Russia's rising influence over the past year, especially. But it's pretty remarkable to just step back and look at the whole picture. And to give us a bit more on this aspect of the story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So up until a year and a half ago, Russia's footprint in the Middle East and even its position to mediate future peace in different arenas was extremely limited. I think that National Post article brings out that Jeremiah was talking about earlier, how its place, how Russia has used its place in the United Nations Security Council extremely well over the past 20 or so years, even though it's been quite small in those areas that he discussed. If Russia disagrees with any of those members on the Security Council, it could veto the resolution, and then the United States would be hamstrung about what it could do. Well, nowadays, what we're seeing is Russia use its position of influence directly by inserting itself, not just with a vote at the Security Council, but inserting itself into key arenas in the Middle East. It started with Syria back a year and a half ago when it decided to help out the Iranians support Assad, and they sent forces down there on the cheap, as Jeremiah brought out. The bang for its buck that it got in Syria as far as showing the world America's diminished role, and now brokering Syrian peace. There's a big peace conference coming up this week, taking place in Kazakhstan. And there will be Turkey, Russia, Iran, and just this past week, Russia has invited the United States there underneath a new administration, which is interesting because he denied Obama a place about 3 weeks ago at a similar one of these. But Russia is trying to figure out the future of Syria. But it's not just Syria where this is happening. If we look further to the east, if we go to Afghanistan, for the past 6 months, Russia has been inserting itself there in support of the Taliban, believe it or not, which used to be a Russian enemy in Afghanistan, but it has supported the Taliban. It even looks like in January they gave the Taliban arms as well, which means that if the United States wants to work out a deal in Afghanistan to get its 10,000 soldiers home, now they're going to have to go to Moscow and talk to Putin about that. Then if we go over to Libya, they've inserted themselves in that situation as well. Libya, of course, is really in the midst of just a horrible situation where the country is very divided. We had the United States and Europe trying to set up a government in the west of the country, as we've talked about a lot. And here comes Russia supporting the government in the east of the country. Now, if you want some peace worked out in Libya, you have to go and discuss it with Russia as well. Then take Cyprus. Right now, we've got this Cypriot unity between the southern Greek part and the northern Turkish part. Looks to be as close as it's ever been. And yet we see Russia putting pressure on Turkey to continue to have its army there. A lot of Russians invest a lot in Cyprus. So and they're inserting themselves in that situation so that if Cyprus wants to be unified, they have to talk to Russia about that as well. So yeah, it doesn't have much power. But in each of these Middle Eastern hotspots, who is the key player now? It is Russia. You have to discuss these situations with Russia if you want a solution.
I just wonder, this has to be a cause for tremendous concern to Europe, particularly given the fact that under a Trump administration, it seems that Russia's hand will only be strengthened, and you could see it being even more capable of asserting itself the way that
it is right now. Yeah, I really do think Mr. Trump sees what has happened, where we are going. I think we're going away from an international consensus way of doing foreign policy, of working at peace at the UN, with Mr. Trump coming in. And Mr. Trump sees Putin involved in all of these areas, and he knows he's going to have a partner in Putin with Putin in, if he wants to figure out Syria, if he wants to figure out Libya, if he wants to figure out to get the troops home from Afghanistan. He's going to have to work with Putin in all of these areas. Putin has been so smart. He's increased his position in broader dealings with Washington and also the EU, and he's increased his bargaining position now with them because he can hang all of these issues over the EU's head. If they don't solve one, will he bring up another area that they need to work out peace with?
Well, that really is an interesting point to make. If we're moving away from international consensus, UN-based solutions or attacking different problems in the world, and more of this kind of bilateral or one nation with another nation coming together and trying to solve it on their own, and you see influence increasing on the part of Russia in particular. Next segment, we're going to talk about China proposing itself as a solution to international economic problems. Really an interesting trend that we should keep our eyes on. Thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about China's president asserting China as the new champion of globalization, more tension rising between Egypt and Saudi Arabia and what this could mean for the Middle East, the threat that unprecedented levels of personal debt in America poses to the American economy, and the Anglican church leaders who are actually apologizing for the Protestant Reformation. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
What will the relationship between America and China be like under a Trump presidency? It's a very important question. We might have gotten a hint to the answer this week at the Davos World Economic Forum. This forum has long been a venue where elites from Europe and America gather to establish the framework for global affairs. And on Tuesday, Xi Jinping became the first Chinese leader to ever attend the meeting. His presence there and the remarks that he made were very telling. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the annual meeting there in Davos, Switzerland, that's been going on every January since 1971, and it's basically where mostly European and American elites assemble to really set the stage for global affairs, to set all kinds of industry and regional and global agendas. And it's a forum for the movers and the shakers. So the fact that the Chinese president ended up really seizing the stage during his first appearance there at this venue is significant. And he used that stage to basically announce to the world that China is now the world's new leader in terms of being the champion of free trade and the guardian of the international order. He basically said that since America under President Trump wants to drastically scale back its role as the, you know, the kind of the leader of the international order, then China wants to be the power that fills that vacuum and to take on that role. He was very critical of Mr. Trump's administration. In one clear jab at Mr. Trump, Mr. Xi warned, let me see, he warned against those nations who, quote, bend the rules as they see fit or walk away from their commitments, end quote. So he's not naming Mr. Trump by name in those statements, but they were clearly directed at him, and everyone present understood what that really meant. And then the very next day, Mr. Xi traveled to another Swiss city, Geneva, and he spoke to the UN there about the need for the world to get free of nuclear weapons and the need for us to have an age of world peace, and about China's desire to really be the one that ushers in that age of peace. The China Daily newspaper chimed in on the significance of these speeches. It said, China has become the de facto world leader seeking to maintain an open global economy and battle climate change. In effect, President Xi has become the general secretary of globalization, end quote. So at face value, it sounds pretty good to a lot of people. Apparently, a lot of the Europeans and others in attendance there received these speeches really well. But the reality is that, you know, China is not a beacon of stability and benevolence. It's certainly not a champion of peace. And Mr. Xi's attempts to present China in that way is really just a facade. China has been one of the biggest beneficiaries of globalization, but it's not a supporter of what Westerners really mean when we talk about free trade and when we talk about a system governed by rules, things like that. You know, China has relied on all kinds of subsidies and state aid and various hidden trade barriers at all levels of its economy. So the Chinese version of globalization is entirely different from the one that America has led for so long and the one that has brought so much prosperity to the world. And I think if you also consider China's aggression in the South China Sea that we've spoken about many times, and China's refusal to comply with all kinds of international rulings in the UN and elsewhere, you know that the only global peace that China would really want is one that has China at its head. Mm-hmm. George Magnus from Oxford University's China Center said, if people really understood what China wants the rules of the game to be, they would be rather less in awe of these speeches and of Mr. Xi's desire to lead the world. So, you know, the world is rapidly changing, and despite the optimism about Mr. Xi's speeches there, if China is able to change the rules of the game, then, as Mr. Magnus said, it would not usher in an age of global prosperity at all.
Is there any sense of how these other nations responded? You said that he received quite a significantly positive reception there. And we've talked about just how much Chinese economic initiatives over this past year or two have been an opportunity for investors and other nations to maybe move away from their relationship with the United States, their dependency on the United States, and China's really been positioning itself to be somewhat of a replacement for that. Does this accelerate that? These other nations seem like they're willing to go along with that.
I think it would accelerate it, at least to a degree. Right now, there's, you know, as we spoke about in the first half, just so much uncertainty about Mr. Trump's America, what that's going to mean for Europe. People are frightened. And so I think if we did not have Mr. Trump in office, then these kinds of remarks would fall mostly on deaf ears among Europeans. But in light of Mr. Trump's inauguration, the Europeans are saying, I'm sure that this is too good to be true, but nevertheless, we've got to start considering some alternatives. So they're probably a lot more open than they otherwise would be.
Interesting to think of, too, in relation to what we talked about in the first half about Russia and its how well it has positioned itself in the world, even given limited resources. And we were talking about their wealth. We were talking about their manpower. When you think about a Russia-China alliance and these two increasingly powerful nations pooling their resources together, you could see how the two of them combined would be able to have significant impact beyond what either of them could do alone.
That's true. They seem like very natural complements in a way. You know, what China lacks, Russia has to a great degree in terms of military technology and other things like that. And then what Russia lacks, particularly in population, China has in abundance.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. We've been tracking the decline in relations between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Well, this week, a court ruling in Egypt put more tension between these two countries. One analyst says a fracturing of this alliance could really have major implications for the Middle East balance of power. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
This specific court ruling really shut down the government of el-Sisi. You remember that he wanted to sell or give away two islands that are in the Straits of Tehran below the Gulf of Aqaba, where the Red Sea, where the Sinai Peninsula meets the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. There's two islands there that belong to Egypt. And he was going to or wanted to give them to Saudi Arabia as part of a friendly gift. And while he was for it, the Egyptian people largely felt upset by this, that he was giving away territory that belonged to them. And sure enough, on January 16, an Egyptian court did strike down that decision by el-Sisi to give away those islands, saying it's not his right to give them away because they are sovereign Egyptian territory. It doesn't belong to him to do that. So what we've written up here in the Trumpet Weekly this week is just a look at that decision in a way that it is just another blow to this relationship between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And what the biggest one that has shown up, it really took place back in October, and that was when there was a resolution regarding Syria at the United Nations Security Council, and Egypt decided to support that resolution in support of Russia, one of its other allies, but that was against Saudi Arabia's interests. And at the time then, Saudi Arabia decided that it was going to go back on its word to give up 5 years' worth of different oil products to Saudi Arabia and cut off Saudi Arabia from all of those oil products. So this decision by Egypt to not allow these islands to go through is just another sign that Saudi Arabia is going to be upset with the Egyptian people.
This Zero Hedge article that we are quoting from in the Trumpet Weekly really makes a remarkable point about this and the fact that this could actually set the stage for Egypt to pivot to Saudi Arabia's main competitor in the region. This is something that we've been watching quite a bit.
Yeah, it is. And I think that the leadership in Egypt would not want to do this. They would not want to side with Iran. They would rather be on friendly terms with the Saudis instead of Iran. But what we've seen since October is Egyptian ministers going around to different Middle Eastern states, Qatar, Jordan, and also Kuwait, to try and make up for the loss of Saudi Arabia's oil products. And on one of those meetings, they didn't go to Iran, But Iran did offer. Iran said, I would be happy to supply you with the needs that you have. And this is just another sign that Iran is trying to reach out to Egypt. Iran is definitely the pusher in this relationship. It's always wanted a closer relationship with Egypt. We saw them go after Egypt under the Morsi regime back in 2013 and strengthen ties then. They're always looking to strengthen their ties with Egypt. But Egypt has been the one that said, no, we get out of our business. We're not interested in having Iran over here. But push comes to shove. Egypt imports about 40% of their oil and gas needs, and this deal with Saudi Arabia made up 35% of that. So they're short on 15% of what they need, their daily needs. So Saudi Arabia better be very careful here. If they are going to, if Egypt's going to get what they need, they might go to Iran, and that will be Iran on the, an ally of Iran on the other side of the Saudi Peninsula, something that they don't want.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Under Barack Obama, the national debt rose $8 trillion. But it wasn't the only debt in America that rose over his administration. Personal debt is also at record numbers. And one analyst is saying economic conditions look dangerously similar to, even worse than, those that led up to the economic shock of 2008. For this story, we're going to go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, one really shocking statistic that's been building for a while is they say the average American citizen is roughly has roughly $90,000 in debt, including mortgage, auto payments, and everything, some of those things, which would obviously have an asset value. But yeah, it just breaks down to they're paying almost $7,000 a year just in interest. And then that debt on an average citizen basis breaks down to over $5,000 in credit card debt, an average of about $60,000 mortgage, some $8,000 in auto loans, almost over $9,000 in student loans, and then another $7,000 in other various debts.
Which it all adds up.
It adds up, and which is causing at least some political analysts to warn that the housing bubble might be back. I mentioned that rise in mortgage payments is obviously over the course of the George Bush presidency, the U.S. mortgage market exploded from $7 trillion to almost $15 trillion, which when that bubble popped and people had some economic stagnation, they weren't able to make those mortgage payments anymore, led to the subprime mortgage crisis and the 2009 recession, which we're just barely getting over now. But they also say that in those years since that mortgage crisis, that bubble's blown back up to about $14 trillion again. So it's just, you're really, as far as like the mortgage bubble, we're just about the exact same place you were in 2008. Mm-hmm. And I guess some political analysts are saying some of the consumer confidence that Trump has given might mean that it's not going to pop right away. He might be able to get like an economic revival that would keep things going for a while. But if that debt bubble, but if it does keep going for a while and that debt bubble keeps getting bigger, I mean, that's just kind of a law of economics, is the bigger the bubble, the bigger the pop. Mm-hmm. So it's, if it were to pop right now, you'd have a 2008 level crisis. If it keeps blowing up more mortgage debt over the next 2-3 years and pops later, you'll get something worse than the 2008 crisis.
Yeah, so essentially we're talking about something on that scale, and essentially the scale of the crisis that we're going to see depends on just how much bigger that bubble gets over the next couple of years. If there is more confidence that floods into the market because of a new president, it just kicks the can down the road and the pop is even bigger.
Right. Preferably, and this is a bit of wishful thinking here, is if you had an economic revival, people would take advantage of the economic revival to start paying off some of that mortgage debt and shrink that bubble slowly. Although if history is any indication, if Americans seem to take those economic revivals as permission to spend even more and kick that can down the road for an even bigger collapse.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. This year is the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, and two leading Anglican archbishops have decided to commemorate this event in a very unusual way by demanding that the Church of England apologize to the Vatican. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the most senior leader in the Anglican Communion, the head of the Church of England, has said that Protestants, when they remember the Reformation, need to, quote, repent of our part in perpetuating divisions. He was joined by the Archbishop of York, who has tended to be more of a conservative within the Church of England, but he still signed up to this. And so, and it's a very interesting take because, of course, I mean, they're going even further than apologizing. They're saying that we need to repent. And of course, these are people who've been theologians their whole lives. They are well aware, at least, of the definition of the word repent, which is more than just to be sorry for, as Adrian Hilton, a one-time trumpet commentator or writer, pointed out on his blog. Repent is more than just being sorry. It's a change in direction. It's changing what you're doing. And so if you're implying that you need to repent of your part in perpetuating divisions, well, does that mean bringing the Protestant Reformation to an end? Does that mean turning things around, returning to the Catholic Church? I mean, it certainly implies that. And he even pointed out in there, which I thought it was a great point, are they implying that the Queen needs to repent, for example, of her oath to uphold the Church of England and as independent from Rome? And it's just, I mean, this is something that for hundreds of years, just ordinary people in England have taken pride in, this separation from Rome. And now they're saying, and now these people right at the top of that church are saying, well, actually, we need to repent of this.
Yeah, that really is a remarkable, in light of Brexit, in light of the all of the nationalism that has kind of bubbled up within Britain, for religious leaders to be taking this level of a stance with respect to the religion that dominates the continent is really extraordinary.
Right. And I think the other interesting thing that Adrian Hilton pointed out is that in this document they produced, there was absolutely no mention at all of anything the Catholic Church was doing wrong around the time of the Reformation. Mm-hmm. Things that Anglican leaders would once have held up as major grievances, they don't even mention. And you're right, a lot of they've launched kind of Archbishop of Canterbury said a major theme of his this year is unity. And I think he'd even made some references to Brexit and things like that in that. And he kind of sees, well, his response to Brexit has got to be to push for more unity. And when you also see now with the Catholic Church drawing close to Lutherans in Rome, and there are a few bits of news about that. For example, the Vatican produced a stamp with Luther on the cover, and it's the first time they've honored a non-Catholic religious leader in that role. You do see a major push for unity within the Protestant world this year in this 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, and the timing of that with all of Europe divided and looking for unity is just full of potential for the Catholic Church to take on a much greater role here.
Put this in prophetic context for us, because this is something that we've talked quite a bit about over the, a number of decades, going back to Herbert W. Armstrong.
That's right. It's something that we have a decent-sized chapter on in the He Was Right booklet, because so many of the things that Mr. Armstrong said about this have happened already. He was writing this, I think, even before things like the Vatican II Council, which launched a major outreach for the Catholic Church towards these other Christian denominations. And the Bible says that the Catholic Church is going to gather in its daughter churches, those churches that came out of the Catholic Church. And we've seen so much progress or movement in that direction over the last 50 years. And just so many of the points of division they've gotten through already. And so really what we're looking for is kind of just maybe the last like 5% to take it over the line. And of course, it does take an extra effort to kind of to finish that last 5%. That last 5% is probably the hardest 5%. But so much of the work there was already being done. we've seen so much of that prophecy fulfilled already. We're just watching now for the very last little bit to be fulfilled to bring those Protestant churches back to Rome.
All right. Amazing stuff. Well, thanks for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll start with Richard.
British Prime Minister Theresa May gave a major speech on Brexit this week. She was outlining her position for the negotiation. It's still early days, and I think everything has to be taken with a hefty dose of salt because everyone's just kind of posturing ahead of the negotiations beginning. But she made clear that she's going to push for what's been called a hard Brexit, you know, not kind of trying to keep one foot in the European Union, but to come out of the area of freedom of movement, come out of the customs union. And so this has really gotten a lot of people much more talking about Brexit and kind of set the ball rolling before for Britain beginning the negotiations on that.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
The Russian military said Wednesday that it has teamed up with Turkey to conduct airstrikes against Islamic State in northern Syria. A military spokesman said 9 Russian warplanes and 8 Turkish jets have taken part in the strikes in the province of Aleppo. This statement was the first acknowledgement by Russia that strikes were in support of the Turkish offensive. Turkey, of course, was a longtime enemy of Russia in the Syrian civil war, but now it seems like they're teaming up.
And over to Andrew.
Just a few days before leaving office, President Barack Obama commuted the 35-year sentence of former U.S. soldier Bradley Manning. Manning had been in prison for leaking a trove of diplomatic cables to WikiLeaks. He will be released in May, meaning he won't have to serve the last 3 decades of his sentence.
All right, back to Richard.
Moldova is jumping ship. They have been allied with the European Union. Now they're switching to Russia. The new president held a press conference in Moscow with Vladimir Putin on January 17th, and he said he planned to sign a memorandum of cooperation with Russia's Eurasian Economic Union and that he would be pulling out of the treaty that he signed with Europe. So another sign of Russia's growing influence there in the borderlands between those two power blocks.
We'll have to make sure that's reflected on our map in the next trumpet. And now over to Jeremiah.
Russia and China are furthering their cooperation to challenge America's missile defense system in South Korea. The U.S. has been working to build what's called a Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD system. And the THAAD system is designed to guard against North Korean missiles. But Russia and China don't like it, so they're planning countermeasures against it. They've not yet said what these measures will be, but we can be sure that they will not build peace in the region.
All right, let's go back to Brent.
On Monday, European Union foreign ministers expressed their opposition to any plan by President Donald Trump to move the United States embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The foreign ministers warned that such a move could ratchet up tensions with the Arab world. The European Union's foreign policy chief cautioned against unilateral action that, in her words, could have, quote, serious consequences in large sectors of public opinion and in large parts of the world. However, President Donald Trump was asked by Israel Hayom on Tuesday in Washington if he intends to go through with his pledge to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And he responded, quote, "Of course, I remember what I said about Jerusalem. You know, I am not a person who breaks promises."
And Richard.
We've spoken on this program before about German foreign policy thinkers calling for the nation to get nuclear weapons. Well, we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly this week from an American foreign policy expert calling for Germany to get nuclear weapons. He argues, well, why should we be responsible for bringing nuclear World War III to protect Europe? Let Germany get the weapons and take on that responsibility themselves. So it's just really interesting to see how this discussion has dramatically accelerated since Donald Trump's nomination, and also just how kind of cavalier and relaxed America's foreign policy establishment is about having these nations that have historically been opponents of America get weapons of mass devastation.
Absolutely. And we'll finish with Andrew.
Cybersecurity experts at the World Economic Forum said on Wednesday that large-scale cyber attacks are increasing. One leading industrial official said that his company was experiencing some 300,000 cyber attacks daily. The experts recommended that there needs to be more collaboration between government and business in order to increase cybersecurity.
That's a lot of hacking. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com. It will give you a subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly, absolutely free. It has everything that we talked about on today's show and a whole lot more. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of George Washington at America's very first presidential inauguration. There is no truth more thoroughly established than that there exists in the economy and course of nature an indissoluble union between virtue and happiness, between duty and advantage, between the genuine maxims of an honest and magnanimous policy and the solid rewards of public prosperity and felicity. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.